Hi, and thank you for joining us today for Destigmatizing Urology, an official podcast series from Urology Times. As we all know, stereotypes and misleading information circulate within the field of urology, and these miscommunications can negatively affect doctor-patient counseling and decision-making. This series destigmatizes topics in urology alongside clinical experts to help listeners practice more efficiently and foster better relationships with their patients. I'm your host and Urology Times Assistant Editor, Janelle Hart. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Ashley Winter. She discusses why the misconceptions of sexually transmitted diseases and infections are hindering patients from seeking appropriate care, and how urologists can help to rid of these misconceptions. Winter is a urologist at Kaiser Permanente in Portland, Oregon. So if you could start by explaining the stigmas surrounding STDs and STIs.
Yeah, sure. I'd say another way to rephrase that is kind of misconceptions around STDs or STIs. So some common misconceptions are that, you know, the only people who get sexually transmitted infections are young people, like teenagers, or maybe people in their 20s. And certainly, you know, if you are sexually active or even not currently sexually active, but have ever been sexually active, you can be diagnosed for the first time with an STI. I think that's particularly relevant because, you know, in general, urology populations tend to be older. And, you know, people who are older tend to not think that they can get them. So I think that's a really important misconception to be aware of. Now, while they're more common in people of younger ages, they're certainly not isolated to them. It's not like after you hit 35, like you're immune to sexually transmitted infections. And there are certain specific patient populations, you know, you think of like assisted living facilities where you maybe have a large congregate living setting and you have people being sexually active with each other who sometimes are not using protection because they're beyond the childbearing years. So they may think that they don't, you know, need it as much, and they can still transmit, you know, other sexually transmitted infections such as, you know, chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, herpes. So, you know, that's a big misconception. I think a misconception that's really important is that monogamous people don't get STIs, right? So a common example, right, is that herpes is the extremely common sexually transmitted infection. And there's some data that probably up to 87% or so of people with herpes are asymptomatic carriers, meaning that if you tested their blood, they'd be seropositive and you say, oh, this person has HSV virus, herpes simplex virus, but they never had an outbreak. Okay. Like they never had, you know, herpes lesions. And that person, let's say, could be in a monogamous relationship and they could transmit it to their partner, and asymptomatic transmission is a possibility, you know, and there's even specific like New England Journal of Medicine article looking at this and showing that there were people who were in long-term committed monogamous relationships where one of the partners, let's say, showed up positive for the first time with herpes that they got from an asymptomatic partner where there had not been any other sexual activity outside of the relationship, right? So when there's poor understanding of concepts like that, you know, let's say one of the partners goes to the doctor, gets diagnosed for the first time with herpes, they're a year into their relationship, they go home, tell their partner like, hey, I have herpes, and then get accused of cheating or something, right? And it's like, no, it's actually possible that you were in a committed monogamous relationship without anybody stepping out on the side, and that there was a first-time diagnosis of a sexually transmitted infection. And also some sexually transmitted infections, let's say, have a higher rate of asymptomatic carrier status in males than in females, or vice versa. So those sort of things are possible. So I'd say that's another misconception. And then I just think, you know, from a stigma standpoint, there's been such a focus on sex ed in school systems that doesn't focus on understanding these diseases, but focuses on things like abstinence only. And unfortunately, saying, okay, if you don't ever have sex, you won't get an STI is not effective, because human nature is such that, you know, humans are sexual beings, and teaching abstinence only doesn't ever prevent people from engaging in sexual activity. So you really need to educate. And when you don't educate and you just say don't have sex, then sexually transmitted infections become highly stigmatized. This idea kind of like you failed or you're dirty and that you don't take your health seriously. So I think those are some top three that come to mind. One, that it's only for young people. Two, that you have to have multiple sexual partners to get an STI. And three, kind of the stigma just associated with our educational formats that stress not having sex over understanding how these conditions are treated.
Absolutely. And so how do these stigmas or misconceptions impact the management of patients with these different conditions?
Well, because there's so much stigma, patients don't want to bring it up, let's say, right? I mean, sometimes they do, but oftentimes they don't. People will just be hesitant to bring it up, or they'll like not want to be tested for it, right? I mean, I've had somebody come in the office and they were having burning with urination and they had blood in their urine and they didn't have any sign of a bacterial infection and ended up doing a cystoscopy. And their cystoscopy showed what looked like herpes lesions inside of their urethra, which is possible. And I said, you know, I think you have herpes. And they're like, I couldn't have that. Essentially because they feel like I'm shaming them, right? And I wasn't trying to shame them. I don't impute any moral value on having an STI diagnosis. I was bringing it up because I wanted to provide effective treatment. So when somebody says in their mind, okay, having this diagnosis is negative and my doctor talking to me about it is an accusation, then it makes resistance to treatment because it's like admitting something bad about yourself when it shouldn't be that. If your doctor said like, hey, you have high blood pressure, you wouldn't be like, I am a good person. I couldn't have high blood pressure, right? Right. So we need to just approach STIs as the medical conditions they are, because until we do, until we take those stigmas away, people will truly have resistance to discussing it, hesitance to discussing it, and resistance to diagnosis and intervention.
And so what are some innovations, you know, in this space that have maybe helped to manage the quality of life for patients who suffer from these different conditions?
Yeah, I mean, the first, of course, is just treatment, right? If somebody has an STI, you know, things like chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, like having a low threshold to talk to your doctor if you're concerned that you have an STI, being screened for it and treated for it, you know, within a rapid time frame is going to improve your quality of life, right? Like chronically untreated chlamydia, gonorrhea can lead to fertility problems, can lead to chronic pain, you know, syphilis more directly, if it goes untreated and progresses to some of these later stage, can have permanent health effects. So those are all things that, you know, lowering our stigmas and having a lower threshold to diagnose and treat are going to be helpful. And then there are some, you know, really innovative things from the standpoint of viral suppression in terms of managing quality of life, right? So the two biggest ones that come to mind are herpes suppression. So when you think of like a valacyclovir, commonly known as Valtrex, that can be given to somebody with frequent outbreaks or even potentially to somebody who's asymptomatic, who has a partner that's not positive for herpes to reduce transmission, right? So that can improve quality of life. Like, yes, herpes cannot be cured, but there are options if you have frequent outbreaks to reduce the frequency of the outbreaks. And there are options, you know, if you're in a relationship or even having any sexual partners, to improve the safety of your partners by being on that viral suppression. And then obviously a huge, huge one is in the HIV space, right? I mean, HIV is a sexually transmitted infection. And, you know, at some point when it initially came on the scene, it was a deadly disease. And with modern antiretrovirals, it's really a diagnosis and not a death sentence, right? And most individuals with HIV live full lives with normal life expectancies. And so antiretrovirals, just A, from the really obvious standpoint of maintaining life and health, but B, from the standpoint of, you know, making somebody have undetectable viral loads and allowing them to engage safely in sexual activity. And those medications also being used in pre-exposure prophylaxis, right? Which is where we have higher risk individuals taking it who aren't even HIV positive. And we've come to a point in time where you could have, you know, let's say somebody who's in a relationship with someone who's HIV positive and they are not HIV positive, and the non-HIV positive person is taking PrEP and the HIV positive person is on their antiretrovirals and has an undetectable viral load and they are safely having intercourse without protection and can be confident that they are not going to transmit the disease, which is really, you know, a radical paradigm shift from the way we conceived of HIV 30 years ago. So that's really just so incredible. Now, you know, the ability for these things to be treated, of course, does not diminish the importance of having safe sex using condoms. And I think that there is some safety net in our minds because of the treatability of these conditions that has, you know, potentially reduced the use of things like condoms. And what we are seeing is increasing rates of particularly chlamydia and gonorrhea throughout the last several years, and particularly with gonorrhea, some multi-drug resistant forms of gonorrhea that are very hard to treat. And these are really like on the rise. And I think as all our public health attention is focused on COVID, we've kind of turned away from, you know, the startling rates of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and actually even syphilis in this country. So definitely, you know, is important to incorporate, you know, use of condoms and other types of barrier protection if you're having multiple partners.
What would you say is the urologist's role in destigmatizing STDs or STIs?
I think you know, if a patient comes in and wants to ask for that screening, to just be supportive and offer it, to not be judgmental. I mean, I hear horror stories of doctors saying, oh, like, you're really getting it on, or making comments that are just judgmental comments, you know, like, don't do that. For the very simple starting place of just don't be judgmental, just do what you're there to do, which is provide care. I think another thing that can be done, you know, I know there's an overuse of like questionnaires and stuff, but I think including questions of like, you know, would you like to be screened for STIs? Are you concerned about any sexually transmitted infections, like on your intake questionnaire, can be helpful, because sometimes the patient is afraid to bring it up in conversation, but when they're checking those boxes, they feel more comfortable. And then it gives the clinician the space to initiate that conversation during the encounter. So that can be helpful. Yeah. And I think just remembering again, that it's any age of your patient. So like in 6 years of urology residency, we talked about sexually transmitted infections very rarely. I think the concept amongst urologists is it's kind of like a primary care thing, but undiagnosed STIs can have a lot of overlap with conditions we treat. So if you're talking about chronic pain, dysuria, hematuria, you know, various sexual dysfunction, testicular pain, you know, we have to be keeping these things in our differential diagnosis and not assuming that like somebody in the primary care environment has already got into that, especially as our patients age and they may be seeing a urologist more frequently than maybe even their primary care. If I have a bladder cancer patient, I might be seeing them 4 times a year, whereas they might have seen their primary care once. So be open and available to that, you know, aspect of things.
Great. And lastly, Dr. Winter, is there anything else you feel our audience should know about this specific topic?
Sex is wonderful and people of all ages should enjoy it. And don't feel hesitant to talk to your doctor about it. And if they are not making you feel comfortable, find somebody who does, because, you know, sex positive providers are something that all people deserve to have. So
be sure to subscribe to Destigmatizing Urology on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps. You can get the latest clinical perspectives and practice management advice by visiting www.urologytimes.com. Thank you for listening.